Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're touching into two really fun cookbooks today and the authors who produced them.
And fascinating life stories to go along with them, exactly. We might add, by the way. Right. Yes.
The first one is Camino. And we're dealing with a couple here, Russ and Allison.
And their restaurant's called Camino, and their book is called
This Is Camino.
So it is. It's all about the chef. It's all about his recipes, about his approach, which is really fascinating. And you're going to be interested in the story, even if you're not going to want to cook the recipes. But I suspect you're going to want to do that too. So here's what's his name.
Why do you do this?
I caught her not looking at the sheet there.
We're going to be talking to Russell Moore and okay. Allison Hopeland, both of them, actually.
Good, good.
We're going to be talking about a restaurant that I haven't eaten at yet, but I sure will, called Camino, and the book is actually called This Is Camino. It's the intention of the co-owners, Russell Moore, chef, and Allison Hopeland, to convey what it really means, the restaurant itself, what its concept is, what the underlying approach to food is. And boy, you guys did a really good job of that, I think. I wasn't sure when I started. I read Allison's introduction where she said she wasn't sure if you wanted to do a zine or a a picture book or whatever it was. And we've gotten those. We've had Dirt Candy was a comic book, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was.
Amanda Cohen. You ended up with conveying your philosophy, I think, just beautifully in this book. Can you sum it up, Russ?
Sum up the book?
Let me know. First of all, I guess Allison says that she figured that what Camino was you.
Thing about Camino, before Camino, I had a really great job. I was a chef at Chez Panisse, which is a really great job. I was also the produce buyer, so it was really hard to leave that, but I knew it was time for me to do something else after being there for 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And so Camino was one of the ideas of Camino was, let's do everything, let's only serve things that we like, let's only have a set up a work environment that we like, let's not cut any corners, not meaning spending a lot of money, but let's just really have an idealistic restaurant that's fun, and that's how it was designed. That's why we cook in a fire, because I'm just naturally kind of attuned to cooking in a fire and having a changing scenario every night rather than recipes and oven temperatures that are set a certain way. And then we just Allison and I made conscious decisions about every single thing that we do, like how are we going to buy our alcohol, how are we going to buy our wine, how are we going to buy our vegetables, how are we going to set up the dining room. That's what Camino is. So it turns out when you make a lot of personal decisions about your restaurant, it ends up being a little bit controversial here and there. When you don't like the decaf that was offered by the coffee company, we don't serve it, and people got a little upset about that. But we wanted to like what we serve, so that's the idea of Camino.
Right. And you say that your larder is the heart of the restaurant. I am envious.
It became the heart of the restaurant. You know, it was a funny time. We opened the restaurant and we had a very simple menu, and we cooked everything in the fire. We bought produce every day from the farmer's market. We did everything that a lot of restaurants do. But it was 2008, and we ended up having no customers because no one was going out to eat. And when the financial crash happened, but I had all these cooks employed. We had all this produce. So we started putting things up in a million different ways, from fermenting things and canning things and making jams. And funny, I was doing that to keep everyone busy and to keep everyone occupied, because you don't want to have cooks standing idle.
Yes.
But what turns out, as things got busier, all those items became essentials to running the restaurant. The herb jam that we talk about in the book, the various fermented things that we do. And it luckily coincided with kind of excitement about preserved foods around these parts anyway. So it used to be if you had a pickled chili, people might think that's kind of funky, you know, and spicy. And now it's become popular, so it's kind of good. It worked out really well. You know, make sauerkraut and various other things, and those things actually sell well at the restaurant, and they provide a little backbone for it. And, you know, I use it I use the pickling juices for various things instead of salt sometimes. I do everything to save money, and I do everything to save the flavor of things that I made. And I think that's how it became the backbone of the restaurant.
Yeah, we have a chef in Pittsburgh with a restaurant called Legume. His name is Trevitt Hooper. You and he would be best buds, I'll tell you. I mean, he pickles everything. He preserves everything.
Actually, he'd be very annoyed at you because he would like to be able to do the 25-mile radius thing and be able to say that everything on the menu 365 days a year comes from that. But the difficulty is he's not in California,
yeah.
Which he used to be.
Right.
He's in Western Pennsylvania, and there are several months of the year where there's practically nothing that's green that's available. So if you don't like...
But he makes kimchi soup, which is really good. He makes his own kimchi.
Oh, I'm Korean, so I like kimchi soup.
There you go.
It's funny, everyone in their own area has to make their own decisions. I mean, I'm blessed to be in an area that has 12 month a year growing season, so I use that because that's what I have here. And we don't have a rule about mileage or anything about the restaurant. We have a rule about each item, you know, like all the vegetables are organic, the wine and beer is all organic. There's really simple things like that.
Huh.
And beyond that, like how we purchase our alcohol, which companies we'll deal with or not deal with, or that we use only whole animals. But I know I'm lucky. I live in Northern California where we have access to all kinds of things. So it's, I didn't want to get too preachy in the book. I just wanted to say what I do and how I do it and try to give an example of a way to run your household or your restaurant or something like that.
Now, this is an amazingly useful book. And I say, how could a book about a restaurant be useful? And then you read the then you read the pages about fire. And I understand fire in an entirely different way now than I used to. First of all, let's say, and many people will already agree with this, charcoal briquettes are a work of the devil, and even worse is lighter fluid.
Oh, that's awful! Yeah.
But then you go beyond that and say, but no, I only cook with wood, and not only that, I'm picky about the kind of wood that I use. And that's okay. This is something that you can do. A lot of people can't. But something that you say you do, which everyone could do if they thought about it, is to have two fires. One fire to make, to cook the food, and one fire to make fire. And that's so amazingly sensible that it gives you an idea that this is not just a cookbook. This is a book with an awful lot of really useful advice for anyone who's going out of their way to try to cook in an interesting fashion rather than in a rote typical fashion. So I was glued to the pages for much longer than I thought I would be because I was picking up just exactly the kind of recommendations.
Well, there's so much in here. Like, how many legs of lamb have we cooked? And here he has this strung up so that it turns around in the fire.
Yeah, well, that you can do that if you're ingenious. I'm not very ingenious. I do know how to cook legs of lamb without burning them on a charcoal grill, which is no mean feat. But it certainly doesn't turn out as well as yours.
It's funny. I think that was a recipe that we were trying to decide whether we should put it in the book or not because it is a really challenging recipe. But I think that it's something that we do at Camino fairly often, and it's one that we really like to do, so we figured we should put it in there. And I thought, there'll be somebody who wants a project. And I think already it's happened. I've seen people post things on Instagram of where they actually built an apparatus and cooked a lamb leg outside Olive Fisal. So it is doable.
Yeah. Well,
and we wanted the book to be useful. We didn't want to have one of those chef books where here's a million recipes that are impossible. I know some of the recipes are really hard, but I wanted to show why and how we do it so you could learn how to do something yourself. And I think a lot of the recipes are actually fairly simple. I just want to show my approach. And then some are more complicated. I mean, I learned how to make paella the first time by reading a magazine article and going into my backyard and figuring out how to cook a paella on the fire. And I thought, well, there's other people like me, too. There's got to be. And I wanted to show not just like how we do it at the restaurant, but how we cook at home. And, you know, by putting up a few things and having herb jam in your larder or having some pickled chilies or something like that, it's really easy to throw together a meal. And if you want to go for it, you can make the ratatouille in the fire and spend all day.
Right.
I don't do that all the time.
I would also point out that the whole restaurant sort of started on how, based on how we cook at home, like more so than how, you know, you were cooking at Chez Panisse, you know, that by using a fire, just mostly because our kitchen at home is so small that Russ would end up cooking dinner outside on a fire, and that sort of became his favorite way to cook, and that's a lot of the reason why we have that at our restaurant.
Well, you know, I mean, I empathize with your home cooking because I've never, ever had a good kitchen. I see these people with four sets of copper cookware and fancy islands in the middle of the kitchen, and they don't, it's really built for their caterers.
Yeah.
We've fed up 200 people at an open house out of our crummy kitchen. So,
but yeah, I mean, you can cook really good food with some really meager equipment.
Yes.
The funny time we had was the first time Anne was confined to bed for a few days, and I got to run the kitchen, and I had no idea how to cook anything on the range. So my energy was expended cooking the protein on the grill outside, and then running inside to cook the vegetables on the on the range inside.
And that sounds a lot like what we do.
you lose a lot of weight that way.
Well, you know, I want to make sure that people know about this. I found it was really, really a wonderful section. In the middle of this cookbook is a diary that I guess your food writer was in the kitchen following everything for a while and figured that a lot was going to be left out in terms of the spirit of your restaurant or understanding the restaurant. So he took it on himself to do a diary for a week. And it's fascinating. Tell us about that.
Well, Chris is a really good writer, and we've always admired his writing, and we didn't want to waste it. So he spent every morning and evening at the restaurant for that week, and he decided just to write everything down and write it like a journalist. And here's what happens, and here's the ebb and flow of everything. And we found it all fascinating, so we decided to put that in the book in his voice. It was easier for him to describe what's going on every day without us saying what we're doing. And I thought, you know, he found it, I wasn't sure if anyone would find that interesting, my daily work, I don't know that is that interesting, but he found it interesting and I trusted him, so we decided to put that in there. And I really like it. I like his voice in the book. I think it adds a little, a little break.
It's also something we really wanted to achieve with the book, is to, you know, to have each element of the book tell the story of the restaurant. So I think the recipes tell the story of the restaurant, and photographs tell that same story in a different way. Uh-huh. And then I think Chris's section in the middle also tells that same story in a third way. So I think that it kind of rounds out the book and kind of makes it a little bit complete.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's also, in many ways, it's a storybook. It's not a cookbook. So I loved your visit with Paul Willis, who we've met a number of times, but nobody's ever mentioned that as he goes around his farm, the pigs all follow him around looking for a treat. And was it him who said that he wants the pigs to have a great life and one very bad day? and you have the same report on where you get your lamb and where you get your chicken and why. And I think that makes for a really good story in this 21st century of caring about that kind of thing, because what you write is real. And this is not just a made up story. This is not just a lecture on what you ought to be doing. This is what you actually did and what you actually do every day.
Right. Yeah, that was the idea. We're reading a lot of books and a lot of interesting cookbooks out there, but a lot of them talk about using a whole animal and doing different things, but I wanted to really show how we do it. Like, here's what we have to do after we cook all the lamb parts the first time. We have to make a ragu out of everything to make money out of it at the end of the day. And I kind of wanted to show how you do that. So the first recipe we wrote for that, I forget what the amount of meat it was, but I cooked the lamb at the restaurant in every different way, and it was a slow night, and I had these leftovers, and I thought, oh, here's the perfect opportunity to write a recipe of what I really do with all this stuff. We cut the recipe down a little bit because it was intimidating amounts of meat, but I thought that was really interesting. Like, it's like this morning, John Watson, who is featured in the book, who we buy lambs from, I butchered a lamb he brought in the other day that's on the larger side. He wanted me to experiment with it. So I before this phone call, I've been out with my phoning knife phoning out this lamb trying to figure out what I'm going to do with it. That's a fun project, and I'm lucky. For me, it's Friday. It's a really big lamb. Uh-huh. I'm going to put it on for dinner tonight, and then hopefully it's going to be for brunch. The leftovers will be for brunch this weekend. But I thought that I wanted to show what we really do. And have it be real.
Now, what will happen to the odd parts? I mean, will you invent a new preparation?
What I do for service tonight, I always try to serve many different parts on the plate. And, you know, it's a restaurant, so we can do that. I'm going to slowly cook the shoulders in the wood oven and then do the leg a la ficelle like we show in the book and grill the rack and loin. But then you have a little bits of all that left over the next day, and we're going to chop it all up in various ways, like the recipe in the book shows for lamb ragu, and then we're going to cook it very slowly.
I love
probably
lamb
serve
ragu.
It with some flatbread. Yeah, me too. But it's funny, I've loved it forever, but since we don't serve pasta, we never make it Italian. I use the term ragu, but we end up making it usually more Middle Eastern flavored dish, but that's almost more fun than the first dish that we started out with, you know, starting the lamb leg and the chop, and that's real fun and everything. But the next day, the ragu, that's what the cooks get excited about, and that's what sells out at brunch. So hopefully that all works out. But if, you know, tomorrow I wake up and there's no lamb left.
Well, you two have a good voice together, too. I mean, Allison, I view you as spunky. Are you spunky?
That's a nicer version of what I might be.
Well, I was, you know.
That's not a
joke. Well, I mean, I get the press because I'm the chef. They always take my picture. I'm on the cover of the book. But this is our restaurant. We make every decision together. And at the bottom line, Allison knows best what works for Camino. Like, mm-hmm. If I make a dish, I'll taste it with my co-chef, Michael, who has one of the best palates I've ever seen. But when I really want to know, does this dish suit Camino, I give it to Allison, and she'll say yes or no.
Yeah, well, she knows you. She knows you pretty well. I love that.
I hope so.
Here's a question for you. So you sound like you get along with just 120%. But what do you argue about?
Huh.
Come on, answer the question.
What do we argue about?
Which plate to use sometimes.
Yeah. Got it, okay.
How we word something on the menu, which employees should do what, little things like that.
Uh-huh.
We argue, for sure.
If the laundry got folded. Same stuff everybody fights about, I think. I will say, when it comes to the restaurant, we are really strangely in agreement, and I think we worked on opening this restaurant for, like, probably 5 years before we actually opened it. So we had a lot of time to work out really what we wanted it to be like. So now it's like the decisions that we make about the restaurant, we're pretty much in line with, uh-huh. with all of those things. We don't have a huge selection of plates to plate things on, so it's like, is it the 10-inch plate or the 10.5-inch plate? You know, it's not super, super important, but it is a crucial little difference, you know?
Right. Now, Russell, you have a great way of putting things that, you know, just, again, Peter talked about the fire and how your explanation added a whole new dimension to his experience. But I'm talking about, like, you start off the section on duck with duck is a self-esteem builder. I love that. What do you mean by that?
Well, you get so much from a duck. I mean, I make blanket statements sometimes in the kitchen, like, you know, an animal, if you butcher an animal and cook it correctly, it should provide enough sauce to sauce that animal. It's a way of making sure that cooks don't use too much sauce, basically, uh-huh. you know. But, you know, when you roast the bones from a particular animal, you make a little stock, and then we braise parts of it, and we mix those braising juices with the meat stock, and that's the sauce that keeps everything warm on the plate, you know. It's a nice little thing. But a duck, there's so many extras. For some reason, it makes too much sauce. There's too much fat that you can make a million other things with. And that's what's great about it. You know, when times are tough, if we order a bunch of ducks, I know that I'm going to get duck cracklings, I'm going to get duck fat to cook potatoes, I can make consomme out of it, We can use the giblets to make a little toast. We can use the liver to make a little stuffing. Yeah. It's just a real easy, compact animal that provides so much. More than a chicken, I would say. And I love chicken, but a duck really just gives you so much.
It's not as overwhelming as a goose. I mean, someday I'll tell you the story of Peter's cooking the goose on the grill.
Geese are trickier. Goose fat. I almost wanted to write about goose fat in the books. I love it so much, but we don't use it much, so we didn't. But a goose is a wonderful animal. So that's trickier. A duck is easy to get your head around a whole animal.
I also think that for cooks, you know, starting out at home, if somebody wanted to use, you know, start with a whole animal and learn how to butcher, a duck is a really good starting point, and you can feel really good about yourself because you can find a way to use all the parts of that animal much more easily than a goose or a lamb or a pig.
Well, you know,
I've never reading your section on all the parts of a pig. I mean, really, I don't think I've ever had, and I also said this once last week, we're awful people, but I've never had a pig's tongue. I've had beef tongue, I've had all kinds of tongues, but never lamb's tongues, but never had a beef tongue. I mean, a pork tongue. Pork tongue. Pig.
Oh, a pig's tongue, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, they're delicious. I mean, we just boiled the pig's head today. We're going to make pozole out of it, but the tongue is the prized part. Like, it's such dense but kind of fatty texture, and it's pretty delicious.
Well, I'm not a dessert person, but I would say that even your dessert section is worth this book. Somebody who wants a grilled fig leaf ice cream with grilled figs, that's my kind of dessert. And then how about your Camino Negroni? You have a cocktail section as well. I think it's a gem of a book. Again, it's Russell Moore and Allison Hoepling, and with Chris Cullen, who did the interesting diary. And it's called This is Camino. And I don't know what I want to do first, cook from the book or rush out to California and eat at your restaurant.
Well, you're welcome anytime. Just let us know.
Yeah, we should.
Yeah, but read the book. You can read the book on the plane, and then you can eat dinner at the restaurant.
Okay.
We should mention, just not to make it difficult for people who can't read but can only listen. The restaurant is in Oakland, not in San Francisco, but you can get there on the BART, and you can find out more at CaminoRestaurant.com, which is a really difficult website to remember. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us today. But thank you also for the entertainment that was involved as we prepared for this interview by reading your book. It really was a pleasure, and sometimes it's not.
Well, thanks for reading it, and thanks for having us on the show.
Right.
Yeah, it's really nice to talk to you both.
And you too. Ciao, ciao.
Okay, bye.
One of the things we should have mentioned at the beginning, which is one of the most fascinating things about this book, is that the chef is just as interested in his wood as he is in the ingredients that he puts in his recipes. So he's got a wide variety of different kinds of wood that he uses to cook on. And he had a very interesting... Wasn't this the man who had the very interesting hint that when you were starting off cooking... You should make sure that you add plenty of fuel. So he lights a second fire next to the first one.
Makes sense.
So that he's not going to run out of charred wood and ashes to be able to continue the cooking process if it takes longer than he thought. An interesting thought never had occurred to me. But then you of course knew that because you're all very smart. But anyway, we'll be back after a short break, with the story of a cooking pot.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
welcome back. I wish you could be looking at this book, this lavishly photographed and laid out book. You'll buy it and you'll see what I'm talking about. It's called Danabe or Danabe. It's Japanese, and I'm not a Japanese speaker, obviously. But it is both a vessel, a cooking pot, and a whole range of types of dishes. That sounds so comforting and wonderful. I feel I could smell them looking at these photographs, and I wish I had one right now.
And the intriguing thing is that it's all based on a particular kind of geology, a particular kind of clay.
Exactly.
That comes from a particular spot in the country of Japan. And the main author of the book who fell in love with Danabe and essentially created a whole lot of recipes that went along with all the different aspects of what you can do with the Danabe that you can't do any other way.
I've been in love with clay pot cookery for quite some time, but didn't know that it was actually a very important part of Japanese home cooking. But now we have a book. Yeah, now we have a book, Danabe. Is that it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Classic and modern Japanese clay pot cooking that tells us all about it. And we're going to be talking to the co-authors, Naoko Moore and Kyle Connaughton. You did a wonderful job on this. It's a very complicated story, so let's try to simplify it a little bit. Kyle, you have an enormously interesting background in cooking, and influenced strangely by a lot of modernist cuisine, having opened the Fat Duck with Hester Blumenthal, or worked there. You were head chef of research and development. You also you wrote and edited Modernist Cuisine for Nathan Myhrvold. And you have your own operation now, your own restaurant, which is a combines a farm and a restaurant, which is a very modernist cuisine. And yet we're talking about this very old cooking tradition in Japan. Now, Naoko, that's where you come in here. You, of course, were born in Tokyo, and you know about this tradition. But there's another part of the story. How did we get to this point where you discovered this particular pottery source and imported and distributed this in the United States, and ultimately, of course, in conversations with Kyle, you decided to collaborate on a book. But where did it start?
So the clay pot, called Danabe in Japanese, it's a big part of our culture. So growing up in Japan, you don't even think about it. It's there. And it's almost like every household owns at least one Danabe. And so, of course, you know, I grew up eating a lot of Danabe dishes at home. And so it's really just part of our culture, and it's really close to our heart. And after I moved to the United States in 2001, you know, I owned Danabe, but it was when I discovered this particular Danabe made by a different producer for 8 generations from the region called Iga, Japan, in Japan. They don't have a particular design for cooking premium quality rice. So I had a rice made in the Danabe, and I was just really, like, shocked about how amazing the rice tastes when the rice is cooked in this particular Danabe. And I brought it back to L.A., and I shared my Danabe rice, you know, with other people, and everybody was, like, in shock, regardless of their cultural background. You know, of course, my Japanese friends and my American friends. So I decided to import them, and then I started to expand my lineup of Danabe, and it's really, like, to me, introducing Danabe is introducing our Japanese beautiful Japanese food culture and home cooking, you know, through the Donabe, which is really close to Japanese people's heart.
Well, now, you deal with the functionality, how this whole thing works in this book, as well as give recipes, and you deal with six particular styles. It's not all one style. Tell me what they are, the six ones you deal with.
Oh, okay. So the most kind of typical style donabe, we call it in English, we just refer to it as classic style donabe. So it's basically like a casserole style pot. So there's the base, the bowl, and the lid. And that's like a multi-purpose. And most commonly it's used for doing hot pot dishes, and you can do soup, stew, anything you would cook in a pot, you know. So for Japanese cuisine, you know, it's hot pot is most popular, but it can be any international cuisine too. So that's the most kind of common style donabe. And then we have other kind of unique style donabe. Another one is the rice cooker, which I mentioned earlier. So which has more thicker body. So it builds the heat more slowly, and it distributes the heat really evenly and in a nice way. And it comes with the inner lid, which works almost like a pressure cooker. And so it makes the rice really perfectly. And then we have the soup and stew donabe, which is also has a really thick body. So it's really wonderful for soup, stew, and especially for braising. This particular donabe, even after you turn off the heat, it stays very, very hot for a long time. Like you boil something, you turn off the heat, after 5-10 minutes, you can still hear inside simmering. So it's perfect for soup, stew, braising. And then we have donabe steamer. So it's essentially, the look is like a classic style donabe, you know, like a casserole style. It comes with the steam grate insert. So you boil the water inside, and you put the ingredients on the steam grate, and with how the donabe builds the heat, and it also brings the far infrared radiation, it cooks the ingredients faster and more effectively too. And then we have the tagine style donabe. And so it's like design is inspired by Moroccan tagine. The bottom, instead of a bowl, it's more like a skillet. So you can heat the skillet while it's empty too. Even over high heat, it's fine. And you can do, and it comes with the lid. It's like a really like tall dome shape, and there's no hole in the lid. So it insulates the content really nicely. And it also brings it's perfect for cooking like steam frying, also stove top roasting, etc. And then finally we have the donabe smoker. So that's another really unique style. So you extra thick body, and you can heat it empty, and you put the small amount of really like fine the smoke chips in the bottom, and then it comes with the three tiers, the grates insert. And so you can put the ingredients, you know, from, you can put meat, you can put, you know, salmon, fish, other things you want to smoke. And you can set over, gas stove top. And then the smoke chips start to smoke. It won't, like catch fire or anything. It just starts like really nicely smoking, and you cover with lid. And then you can make a nice heat smoke, dish in a short time. It won't even release much smoke, outside with donabe. So you can use it, in your kitchen without, you know, worrying about, setting off the fire alarm.
Now, Kyle, tell us, I want ultimately to find out. The question is how you got involved with this, but I was so fascinated. You really have lived a charmed chef's life, I think. from your experiences, could you just run through for our listeners some of your opportunities in cooking that brought you around the globe?
Sure. I really grew up cooking in Los Angeles, which is where I first met Naoko-san, and we became good friends. And then I moved to Japan for a number of years to cook in the North Island of Hokkaido, which is a very kind of beautiful but very long winters and very cold.
Yeah, I just found out. I had asked Peter, who's a geographer. I never knew that it was so Arctic.
Oh yeah, it's very, very long winters, very, very cold, but very beautiful and mountainous place. And I was working there for 3 years for Michel Brau, which is a 3-Michelin-star restaurant from Laguiole, the south of France, second restaurant. And I was there for 3 years with my family, and also had the opportunity to work in many more classic Japanese cuisine restaurants as well, and study Japanese cuisine, and really fell in love with donabe there, because so we did have these very long winters, and so you know, both to sort of feed the family and to warm the house, we cooked many sort of donabe hot pots in our home, and we really fell in love with that there, because it brought our family, it brought our two young daughters with us, and it brought our family and friends together around. It sort of warmed us and warmed the house, and so we had a very a love for donabe. And then after Japan, we moved outside of London, and I was the head chef of research and development for Heston Blumenthal at the Fat Duck.
Who we love. Yeah, we love Heston.
Oh, great. Thank you. I do too. And that was a really great opportunity to do the development of a very sort of very interesting modernist cuisine, cooking there with Heston for 5 years. And Naoko came out and visited and spent some time also with us in our home cooking donabe and in the restaurant, as well. And that's, you know, at the time she was, you know, starting to, you know, as she was saying, you know, bringing the beautiful donabe from Iga, starting that process into the U.S. And it was just something, it was a passion that we both shared. And then when we came back, I came back to the U.S. and helped work on the Modernist Cuisine series with Nathan Myhrvold, and wrote a culinary science bachelor's program for the Culinary Institute of America. And began to work on the process of opening my own restaurant in Sonoma, California. Naoko and I sort of reconnected about what she was doing in donabe, and she was very generous to sort of share what she was doing, and also to bring me to Iga to meet the family and the artisans who produce them. So, you know, she's been my sort of guide and teacher and through the wider world of donabe, and so you know, I've learned from her and from that family, and then we really decided to, you know, to share that with the Western world.
Now, what is it, if you can say this at all, well, you just believe, what is it that makes the donabe and the particular ones that you're importing, what is it that makes them so special? Are they superior to other clay cooking vessels? And if so, is it because of the raw material, or is it because of the artisan skill that goes into making them?
I think it's kind of all of the above. So first of all, the region called Iga, that's kind of in the like central Japan, closer to Kyoto and Osaka, about 1.5 drive from each city. It's a very mountainous region. And in the region itself, they have the history of pottery making for over 1,300 years. And so they are known for, historically known for the region for making best pottery. And the family who makes donabe, they've been making donabe and pottery for almost 200 years. They were established in 1832, Nagatani family. So the region and the family, the pottery made in the region called Igayaki. So direct translation is pote from iga. But to be qualified as igayaki is you have to, just say kind of like, you know, wine AOC, you know, to make igayaki, it has to be made from 100% iga clay, so clay from the region. And there's a secret to this clay from iga. It's very special because the entire region, about 4 million years ago, was under Lake Biwa. And so over years, it's now exposed as land. And but because in the prehistoric era, the region was lake bed, the clay contains a lot of fossilized microorganisms. And so you shape and fire to make the donabe made from this particular clay. After firing at such high heat for twice, the body becomes really porous. So porous body means it builds the heat really slowly, but at the same time, it retains the heat for a long time. And also, porous body, iga clay, is like a really, like, it has a high resistance to heat. Iga clay is known for among the highest heat resistant clay for making clay pot. So that's really kind of like something very special about iga clay.
Yeah, it's actually, from a geological standpoint, I guess, it might
yes.
sound ridiculous that, to say that it's 4 million years old means it's rather recent, but in fact it really is rather recent. And imagine, listeners, that in fact it's the mud that collects mm-hmm. at the bottom of the lake as the lake, or the in this case lake, because it's fresh water that's involved,
right.
And as that drains away, and this happened at the end of the glacial era about 4 million years ago, you get left this mud deposit, which over time solidifies enough to be clay, but when you add water to it, then it gets those old properties back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing is the way it works. Interestingly, my favorite cooking pot right now is a clay pot from Emile Henry, made in France.
That's cast iron.
Yeah, it's slightly different, but in its own way, it's a superior performer. And what's happened with the Donabe is the clay it's made from, for the reasons you explained, makes it a superior performer. And then the artisans are skilled at making sure that they build something that seems like, I mean, clay seems like it would be rather fragile, and if you heated it up, the first thing it would do is fall apart.
Well,
but it's, yeah, really durable. And also at Nagatani, and the producer, so everything is handmade, and it takes about 2 weeks to produce each unit of donabe. So it's really made with the artisan skills, and the donabe is meant for everyday use, and you can use for a long, long time with proper care.
Yeah, no, you do talk about all this in the book. I'd like to actually, you talk about how to take care of this and how to use it, mm-hmm. but let's talk about, address two other issues about it. And Kyle, you alluded to it about when you were freezing as a family, it was great to huddle around this pot. And part of the appeal of Donabe-style dinners is the sharing and this the familial aspect,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we love, part of the passion for, you know, the cooking of it. So, of course, the great results that you can get in the cooking, the functional aspects, and just in the beauty of them. But, you know, within that, it's really bringing people around, and that's what we love so much about. You know, we're so used to, and I think in the Western world, of having everyone's food plated, you know, separately, and everyone has their own plate, and so, you know, so much of the Donabe cooking is about gathering around and sharing and participating, and that's really, you know, an aspect of it that we love so much.
Now, the other thing is, and I can't find the exact quote, but somewhere here in this book, you wrote about this question I asked, I mean, how about the modernists, the new and the old, tradition and updating, even the shapes of the pots, evidences sure. that they're doing that. What about the recipes? Can you talk a little bit about that, or are they all... They're not all traditional recipes. They're advanced and developed, right?
Well, the recipes in the book,
yes.
I mean, the recipes in the book, you know, for each chapter, and Nako can speak more to this, but you know, we look chapter by chapter at each of the individual Donabe themselves and explore the sort of functional properties of each. And really, the recipes start essentially through each of the chapters with the most sort of basic and fundamental that really help really understand the use and the function and how they work. And then they get, I wouldn't say necessarily that they get more and more complex. It starts with a little bit more of the sort of maybe traditional use, and then expands on different ideas and different thoughts, and then by the time you get to the end of the chapter, which is really where more of my contributions are, they're a little bit more chef-driven, maybe a little bit more exploring, you know, different ideas within the technique. So, you know, really we hope that through each chapter that depending on what you want to do or what you want to try or what the level of your skill is that you can find something that's, you know, appropriate.
Can you pick out a favorite recipe that evidences or sort of an example of what you're talking about with the dish, and run us through it?
An example of a dish that is
evolved and more your chefy contributions, and just listeners like to hear about different components and dishes and flavors.
Sure. I mean, I think basically my sort of education in Donabe has really been to, you know, to learn from Naoko and the way that she cooks and the way that, you know, some of the traditional uses. And then, you know, we think here at the restaurant or myself as a chef, what are other ways that we can, you know, build off of that and try and explore different things. So we have the one style of Donabe called Fukuda-san. Which is kind of the tangine style donabe, and there's techniques in there for sort of roasting, steam frying, and so we took some of these concepts and are cooking multi-component dishes. So we have one dish in particular that we do. It's black cod, which is a fish that is very common here in Northern California, with potatoes that we get crisp and leeks that are charred, and spinach that's wilted. So we have crisp components, we have soft sort of steamed fish, and we have the charred onion. So three very different types of cooking techniques, but all combined together into one process. And so normally you don't see things that are both crisp and fried cooked together. They're usually
right.
done separately. And then we serve that all together with a pesto that we make from walnuts and nori seaweed.
Yeah, seaweed to me is the up-and-coming hot vegetable. I mean, that's what people are going to turn to, but seaweed, and maybe finally put kale to rest.
We'll see.
Yeah. Now, how about this, Naoko? Can you
yes.
give us an example of one of your favorite dishes?
Well, so this book, you know, consists of mostly my everyday home dishes.
I'd
so
like to eat at your house. Can we
yeah,
come
so
in
all
at your
house? So my recipes are like actual recipes I've been cooking every day, and also featured several recipes from chefs and other from Kyle and other guest chefs. So among all my recipes, I actually do not have one favorite because they're all like something like I just love so much. I actually had even so many more recipes with the book. But because we are running out of pace, so we had to cut dozens and dozens of recipes, even before and after the photo shoot. So these are, you know, these recipes who made to this book are not necessarily like my top recipes, and I also have other wonderful recipes just for the variety, you know, to show the variation of the donut cooking. I selected these recipes, and so I don't know, it's really hard to say which is my favorite, because it depends on the occasion, depends on the season, and so I really hope that people will find, you know, what they like from the book, and then
then we'll
try everything.
And then we'll get book volume two.
Hopefully.
I have a feeling you have most of the content already for book three.
Every day I have something new, so
it
keeps you going.
Yeah, the interesting thing, listeners, just be aware, this is a very broad ranging in terms of the range of the recipes. This isn't all soy sauce and what's that white stuff?
Tofu.
this is got,
Peter's not a fan of tofu.
This has got real chickens, it's got real beef. I didn't actually notice any lamb, but that's perhaps because that's not very traditional to Japan. Is there any pork in there? I'm guessing there probably is.
I cook sometimes lamb, but I think when I cook lamb, instead of steer, I think I just do the grill, you know, on the barbecue or something.
Sure, sure.
So maybe that's why,
right.
Lamb is not, part of my...
Yeah, plenty of pork dishes.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, plenty of, I love pork. I love seaweed.
Now,
me too.
We discovered a small chain, I think, of about five restaurants in London. The name of the restaurant is Shoryu, and their specialty is a very rich pork-based, what's the broth called? The ramen?
Oh, well, ramen shop. I mean, the ramen restaurant.
Uh-huh. So it's not exclusively, but mostly ramen restaurants, but the particular style of gravy they're using calls for it to be cooked for at least 24 hours.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah.
And it's really, really terrific. We loved it.
Yeah, we got introduced. I had no idea that there were how many sake labels did they have?
Over
100.
They had well over 150, I think.
I mean, different, and it was matched to our courses, to the dishes. I didn't know that took place. I thought there was basically two kinds of sake, hot and cold.
and clear and cloudy.
Making four. Well, it's been really interesting to read this book and to catch up on this tradition. And it's just the right weather to be talking about it, too.
Right.
Yeah.
So listeners, this is a whole new world that you can enter via Toiro Kitchen. ToiroKitchen.com. You can, of course, buy the book, which is called Danabi. And pretty soon, Kyle, you'll be opening your own farm restaurant called Single Thread Farms. So there's going to be lots more news from this quarter of the country. And book two and book three of Danabi coming
it's on
soon.
The way.
And we'll see about that.
And thank you so much for joining us and appearing on the menu today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So now you know how to be a Danabi wannabe. Oh, I've been saving that one.
Yeah,
we better close the program before we have any more cornball humor.
Yes.
So what do we say every week this time?
Bye-bye.